So let's, you know, where are we now? Let's start with a little map. Last time I was talking about religion and primarily spoke about the monotheistic religions, which are the ones that have been distinctive in their contribution to science, largely because they, a part of the cosmology of these religions is a privileged place for human beings. Humans created in the image and likeness of God, as the Bible says. And so what that means is that in some sense we are constructed sufficiently like God to be able to make sense of stuff that God has done. So what does this do for the other religions? Well, one reason why I want to talk about evolution at this point is in a sense to kind of talk to you a little bit about the standing that evolution has outside of the West. Okay? Because when we think about the theory of evolution, especially Darwin's theory, we usually think of it as very much part of the modern dispute between science and religion, right? The thing that people get very upset about, because according to Darwin's theory, well, first of all, you don't need God. He doesn't say God doesn't exist. He doesn't have any proofs for that. But basically, the way in which nature unfolds over time does not require the existence of God, right? That is the point. God is not necessary in order for evolution to proceed, according to Darwin, and that is a very upsetting point. Also, the way by which evolution happens is a problem in the monotheistic religions, because it's fundamentally irrational. If you think about reason as having to do with there being kind of a plan in advance, right, where you have certain kinds of laws, like think about Newton's view of the universe, right? Newton's view of the physical universe was that you could explain the motion of all physical bodies from three laws and the principle of gravitation, just by some combination of those things. If you know where things are at various points in time, you can use these laws to predict where they're going to be later or earlier. Okay, that's very rational. Okay, and that was the model for physics, and that was what Newton was about. But this is not the kind of situation that Darwin presents us with. Darwin's view about the way life develops, as you know, the way it gets put in a kind of shorthand, is a random mutation, which basically means that organisms generate a certain limited variety of offspring, you know, but they're not identical to themselves, and sometimes there are some big differences, and those are the mutations. And which one of these survive, of the various offspring produced by organisms, is determined by basically the environment, which is natural selection, right? Natural selection is the environment in its mode as determining who lives and who dies, okay? And of course, part of the Darwin story is that most of the species that have ever lived are now extinct, and that's kind of normal. And eventually everything becomes extinct and gets replaced by other things. That's part of the story too. And another part of the story, which is a part that only really gets elaborated in any kind of detail in the 20th century, is the idea that all creatures are basically made of the same stuff. Right? So in other words, there's no qualitative difference, let's say, between humans and animals. Okay? That's a very important part. Now, Darwin himself didn't know why this was the case. In other words, Darwin didn't have a theory of genetics that was particularly credible, so he didn't understand about DNA or any of that stuff. Okay? In fact, the whole idea of the cell, right, the sort of fundamental unit of life in our bodies, that was only being figured out at the time he was living. Okay. And so if you were to go to, you know, Darwin's works are all online now. Cambridge University has put them all online. So you can go to them and you can see all Darwin's works. And you can do a search for the word cell. Okay? So most of the, much of the biology concerning understanding cells began around the time Darwin was writing in the mid-19th century. So I was curious as to, you know, whether Darwin knew anything about cells and kind of the microscopic side of life. Because we know that Darwin knew about animals and plants, and he was a naturalist, and he observed things and traveled around the world and all that kind of stuff. We all know that about Darwin. And the evidence that's presented in Origin of the Species and his subsequent works are all of that kind. But what Darwin doesn't do is he doesn't talk about the microscopic aspects of life, which are, you know, nowadays we would the most important aspects, molecular biology, genetics, all that. He doesn't really talk about that very much. He speculates, but he doesn't really talk about it in any detail. So the question is whether Darwin knew anything. Well, the word cell does appear in the Darwinian corpus, but it has nothing to do with cells like blood cells or any of those sorts of things, but it has to do with the name of honeycombs. The cells, the honeycomb. That's only cells he talks about. Okay. So the point here is, Darwin has this very kind of elaborate theory. It is a theory that life is fundamentally irrational, so he doesn't understand anything like genetic codes or anything like this. But it's a story that he believes consistently applies across all time. So the kinds of processes that we currently see happening in the world today, so for example, erosion of the beaches and things of that kind, you know, the sorts of things are caused by weather, right? Death that's caused through accidents and normal causes, that all of those causes that we see operating today are exactly the causes that have been operating throughout history, and that there is really no space for any other kind of cause. So there's no divine cause or anything of that kind. Okay? So there's Darwin's theory of evolution for you in a nutshell. Now, the point I want to make about this theory is, in fact, this theory is very compatible with most of the religious cosmologies of the world, especially outside the monotheistic religions. Okay? So if we're talking about Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, okay, we're talking about all those Eastern religions that are not monotheistic, that do not postulate a transcendent God in whose image and likeness human beings are created. All of those religions, very compatible with Darwinism. Because most religions of the world are, in fact, nature-based religions. Okay? And that insofar as there's a creative force, or gods or anything, they are in nature. And sometimes they get personified as, you know, elements of the weather or climate and so forth. And they cause things to happen in the natural world, but they are regarded as natural beings, essentially. Okay? In fact, you know, some of the concepts, especially in the Eastern religions, some of the more abstract, philosophically sophisticated concepts of Eastern cosmologies, so, for example, the idea of qi in the Chinese religion and karma in the Indian religion, these ideas pick up a lot of the notions that we associate nowadays with genetics and heredity and stuff like that. Okay? And what they all have in common, these religions, is a very fundamental thing that's similar to Darwin, namely the idea that we're all made the same stuff and it's kind of like easy come, easy go. Right, in a sense, we're combined together in the way we are for a limited amount of time, right, and then we just kind of die and dissolve and then recombine again and become new things. And it just cycles of this over and over and over again forever. And this is something that's very common to the cosmologies of most of the world religions outside of monotheism, where monotheism typically has a transcendent God, a highly personalized God, that's like a big human being, essentially, with a particular beginning to creation, a plan to creation. All of this stuff, you see, is the kind of stuff that gets thrown into question with Darwinism, but is what makes Darwinism similar to a lot of the other world religions. Okay? Now, one of the ways you see this is in terms of the ease with which Darwin, or not ease, as the case may be, was accepted around the world. Okay? So Darwin writes Origin of the Species in 1859, and then he has this other book that comes out about 10, 15 years later called The Descent of Man, where he explicitly talks about humans, because he doesn't really talk about humans in the first book. And then the interesting question is, okay, how long does it take for this stuff to get translated? Right? Because that's often an indication of the significance that the work has in other parts of the world. Well, one of the things you find that's very interesting with regard to China is that Darwin is translated into Chinese before Marx is. Okay? And in fact, one person who's translated even more than Darwin is in Asia is Herbert Spencer. Now, I hope you people know who Herbert Spencer is. Does that name ring any bells? Who's heard of Herbert Spencer?
Is he like the sociologist that said of natural selection about capitalism that the people who are in power is because of natural selection.
Yeah, yeah, that's basically right. Yeah, yeah, the social Darwinism. What gets called social Darwinism is due to Herbert Spencer, And Herbert Spencer is one of the founding fathers of sociology, basically. And he's the person who, in fact, popularized the word sociology in this country. And toward the end of his life, in the end of the 19th century, he did a lot of lecture touring of the United States and was very influential in American sociology, where this social Darwinism stuff really took off in the United States. Okay? Now the thing is, this guy Herbert Spencer, his books were being translated throughout Asia, and it was through Spencer that most people found out about evolution. Okay? Now the interesting thing was, all of these guys, Darwin, Spencer, all these evolutionists, where they were really receiving the most heat, getting into the most trouble, was in Europe. And that's where they're from. That was where all the problems were. And they were in the United States as well, right? All the Europeanized places in the world. And Darwin had problems in the Islamic world as well. It's interesting, there are some articles written on the reception of Darwin in Islam, you know, in that late 19th, early 20th century period, and it's the same kind of problems that you see happening in the Christian world. Okay? But this does not happen in the Far East. Okay? And this is where you see the differences in the cosmologies operating. Okay? And so, you know, this is a very interesting kind of point. Now, one point I mentioned last time, I don't recall how much I gave a backstory to it, but in the West, okay, in the West, before, because as you know, the monotheistic religions, Christianity gets into the Greek-Roman world really only seriously in the first century AD, so there's this whole period right before Jesus, right, where Judaism is regarded as this kind of exotic colonial kind of religion, in the Roman world and the Greek world, and the Greeks and Romans had their own kind of cosmologies and gods and things like this, and you're probably familiar with them. Mythology, what gets called mythology, right, is largely about the kind of religion that the Greeks and the Romans had, predating Christianity. Now the word religion even, and comes from the Latin religio, and what it means is ritual. Okay, and I was mentioning last time that all the things that we call religion have this kind of ritual conduct of life thing to it. Now, if you look at the religions that were operating in Greece and Rome before the time of Christianity, and I mean the religions that were actually religions, that is to say the bases for ritual, for conduct, right? I'm not talking about, you know, Plato's idea of God, which is almost like a monotheistic idea of God. I'm talking about the kind of religion people live in their day-to-day lives, okay? One of the interesting things about it was that this kind of view was very naturalistic. In other words, the gods were in, they were on Earth, they were operating, they were interacting with us, they were responsible for various things happening in the material world. So we had like household gods, for example, that would protect the house. Okay, so the gods were like localized in that way. They were divided up according to social functions and things like this. If you're interested in this kind of thing, I don't know how, because in a way this is in the history of sociology, religion in this sense of the way in which the Greeks and Romans practiced it is very important in the way in which the concept of society gets developed abstractly within sociology. So Emil Durkheim, as you know, did a lot of stuff on the elementary forms of religious life, and he talks a lot about this. And one of Durkheim's teachers in particular was very important in terms of talking about the role of gods and religion in creating a kind of social solidarity, a sense that individuals live together in a society that goes beyond just inhabiting a particular common physical space, but rather has this kind of history attached to it, this identity attached to it, this collective memory attached to it. And the person I have in mind, and my guess is you have not, the only person in our department who I'd imagine would ever mention him would be Charles Turner. But he's an important guy. And so this was a French historian who Durkheim studied with at the Sorbonne, Fustel de Coulanges. Has anyone ever run across him? I wouldn't have expected you to, necessarily. But he wrote a very famous book called The Ancient City. The Ancient City, which was basically the prototype for the kinds of sociological views and the way in which you know, religion forms as a basis of social solidarity that Durkheim eventually develops much more fully, okay? Fustel de Coulonge, who was a professor of history at the Sorbonne in the middle third of the 19th century, okay? And so this was kind of the Greek-Roman model of religion, where the gods are very much in the earth, in the society, very much kind of the thing that existed before the rise of Christianity. Now, the thing that's quite interesting about this is that, as you know, the Romans and the Greeks were very sophisticated people. They had technology, they had philosophy, they had all kinds of things going for them. But what they didn't have, and this was the thing that always, in a way, mystified a lot of modern people trying to make sense of the Greeks and the Romans, was that they had no sense of progress, especially in a sense of scientific progress. Because if you think about our notions of scientific progress, by the way, let me ask a question, because this is an interesting thing from a generational standpoint. How many people believe in scientific progress? That there is such a thing as scientific progress in a big, you know, in a significant way. Not just that, you know, science improves, but in some sense, science is the motor by which progress occurs in society. How many people believe that? Don't be bashful. It's not an embarrassment to believe this. Okay, well, this is very interesting. So just for the record here, I would say maybe a quarter at most. Put their hands up, maybe a quarter. Okay? You see, when I was a kid, this was taken for granted. Right? Everybody believed, I mean, they still believed in scientific progress in the 1970s, all right? We were talking about, you know, alleviating poverty and saving the world and all this kind of stuff. That was what the 60s was about. We're going to be finally realizing this, right? So this is the reason why I asked you this question, because there's a major generational shift here. Okay? Now, the idea of scientific progress historically, right, you don't have it in the ancient world either. Right? What the ancients believed was not so different from what the people in the Far East believed, which was basically, we're here for a limited amount of time, we might as well make the most of it, and then we're gone. Okay? And so when, you know, Fustel de Coulonge spends a lot of time in his book, for example, talking about the relationship that the living have with the dead. And you know, if you ever read any of the Greek plays, they're full of this business of pouring libations on the burial mounds. Right? You're sort of feeding the gods of the dead and all this, right? And if you don't feed them with wine and stuff, they get angry, okay? So you continue to have a quasi-physical relationship with these people after they're dead. But there's no transcendent world, there's no grand plan, there's no future tomorrow, heaven on earth, there's none of this kind of futuristic stuff, right, that's very much part of the modern progressive view. That's not there in Greece, right? It's rather this kind of ongoing, rather static relationship between the living and the dead. And basically, you have a different set of rituals you perform when you're dealing with the dead than when you're dealing with the living. So in a sense, you know, your parents, they transition out of living to dying through a change in social ritual toward them, but they never really disappear, and it's not like you were some better version. Okay, so it's a very static kind of worldview that these guys have in the ancient world. Alright? And this is very common throughout all the other world religions. There's no sense of progress, there's no sense of going anywhere, there's no sense that things are going to get better or that we're heading somewhere. Now, this is a very important point because the idea of scientific progress historically is basically a secularization of Judeo-Christian Islamic ideas of salvation. Right? Now, if you think about it, one of the things the monotheistic religions have in common, all right, is this idea that we're born kind of in original sin. In other words, I mean, we're privileged to begin with, but then, you know, we make a few bad judgment calls, and we're sort of these mortal beings again, and we've got to somehow pick ourselves up and improve, and then eventually we'll get back together with God again. That's kind of the story of salvation in the monotheistic religions. Okay. Now, what this implies, of course, then, is we're in it for the long haul. There's a sense in which we've got to always be on the move, always improving. We start out with disadvantage, but we have the capacity to improve. This is all built into the religious worldview in the monotheistic religions. Okay? And the idea of temptation, that we can fall back, we might not necessarily always move forward, all this kind of thing is built in there. Now, when you get to the Enlightenment in the 18th century, where people become very skeptical of clerical authority, that is to say, the authority of the priests, okay, what you basically have at that point is you got that story of salvation secularized. It's not that these guys in the Enlightenment didn't believe the story, they just didn't believe the theological version of it, but they believed the scientific version of it. And this is the thing that you see being promoted increasingly in what we call the modern era. The modern era is basically the era of progress. Okay? So through the 19th century, the 20th century, and then when you get to, let's say, the end of the third quarter of the 20th century, then you start to get this skepticism, cynicism, doubt about progress emerge. So that we get to the point now that when I ask you the question, do you believe in scientific progress here at the beginning of the 21st century, only a quarter of you say you do. Okay? So this idea of scientific progress very closely tied to this secularization of the salvation story, that there's some sense in which we're all heading somewhere. Now, why is this important? Well, this is very closely connected to what science is about, in a very deep way. Because if you think about it, right, if you look at what scientists do, okay, not, you know, and just look at their day-to-day activity. And this has been remarked on by many, many, many people, sociologically speaking, that it's very much like kind of monastic activity. You know, the monks, right, in the monasteries there, they have their routines, they work on their vineyards, right, they do all kinds of stuff, they have their various activities, and from the outside, these activities look very specialized and routinized, and they don't seem to add up to very much. Okay, they look very kind of weird almost. Same thing is true of science. You got these scientists, they're in these laboratories, what are they doing? They're mixing test tubes, they're staring at dials all day. I mean, you know, what is this about? Right, very particular, technical, specific kinds of jobs done over and over and over again for your entire life. You're dedicated to this. You think about all these people who work in, let's say, the biological sciences, and they devote their whole lives to, you know, Darwin himself even, who never was a professional scientist, but even Darwin as a naturalist wrote a 1,000-page book on barnacles. Those things in the bottom of the boats. Now, what could you say? 1,000 pages? It's still the definitive work. Not surprising, perhaps. But the thing is that that's very much kind of, you know, and why does the science do this exactly? Why are these scientists working on these very highly technical, specialized kinds of things? Well, if you talk to them, and this is something that immediately appears when they start doing any kind of popularization or public relations kind of work, is the scientists think that all this very small, specific technical stuff is feeding into some kind of bigger picture, right? It's moving the advancement of knowledge. It's adding to this story that all these other people added to, right? So you know, the thing that gives science its forward momentum, even though on a daily basis it's very routinized and minute and technical and so forth, is that there's this overarching narrative, right? Which is the progress part, right? So, you know, you read any work of science popularization, there is always some account of the history of science in there. It might not be great from a historian's standpoint, but it is generally a story of, we started in a state of ignorance, we thought all sorts of crazy things about the world, and then we gradually pulled ourselves up, you know, intellectually by our bootstraps, and we're gradually figuring out how things are, and we're getting better and better at it, and we're controlling more and more things, and one day we're going to have it all figured out. That's always the story. It's a salvation story. Okay? And the idea is, it'll take a long time, it won't happen necessarily tomorrow, but we're getting there. It's a story of progress. Okay? And this kind of story, right, ends up, I mean, in the 19th century especially, this kind of story from science ends up in infusing ideologies throughout society. Right? I mean, 19th century is really where you get all of the progressive ideologies developed. So when you think about Marxism, is probably the one that had the longest longevity right, that there's this proletarian revolution up ahead. The proletariat, they start on the bottom, but they're eventually going to be on the top. And, you know, I mean, this is very common kind of thing you get from the 19th century that has a lot of action in the 20th century. Now, see, Darwin is very different in this regard. So even though Darwin's theory is being promoted in the same period as all these other progressive ideas are being promoted, Darwin's theory doesn't have an end. There is no point to evolution. Okay? There is no destiny. There is no God point at the end, right? You may have seen, you know, if you look at some of the, especially the older books, the new books aren't so much like this anymore, but in the older books that describe evolution, you know, you may have seen this kind of tree of life stuff, right? And so there are all these roots, right, which have to do with the, you know, single-cell organisms at the beginning of time, you know, the primordial soup, as it's sometimes called. And then what you find, you know, as you, you know, as evolution over the billions of years that it takes, right, you get all of these branches, right, the so-called tree of life. And the thing about the tree, right, that is that it just gets more and more branches. Right? It just branches out more and more. Some branches die off, get replaced by other things, but the general story is there is no point, there is no direction, there is no focus. There's just proliferation. Okay? Now, as people study natural history longer and longer, and looked, especially when we got better fossil record, people did more of a paleontological work, okay, and this is something Stephen Jay Gould, who you may have heard of, Stephen Jay Gould, popular science writer, died in the last 5 years, he was very much into this part of the story, we now think that most of the creatures that have ever lived, in terms of different types of species, lived 500,000 years ago, so-called Cambrian explosion. Right? That's sometimes it's called Cambrian explosion. Okay. That's about 500,000 years ago. And that was the maximum point when there were most amount of species around in the planet. And ever since that time, it's kind of got narrow. Things have become more different, but more different within a narrower range. This is the theory that's now promoted. What's interesting about that? Well, the idea here is that if you're into something like biodiversity, right, and you're that is to say to have as many species living in the same ecology as possible, right, that in a sense, from a biodiversity standpoint, the Earth was in its best shape 500,000 years ago, and it's just getting worse and worse. And of course, as you know from a lot of the discussions about ecology and so forth today, we're the culprits. We're killing off everything. Okay, and we've not even been around that long. Okay, this is 500 million years ago. This is different, you know, how long have we been around? Just a drop in the bucket by comparison. We've already obliterated so much. Okay? And so, if you're trying to draw some kind of moral lesson from Darwinism based on this kind of view of nature, right, it's that, boy, we are bad news. Human beings are bad news, and the sooner that nature's rid of us, the better, as far as the rest of the species are concerned. Okay? And in fact, you know, you say, well, what a stupid view. Ha! Not so stupid, okay? If you look at some of the literature in what's known as deep ecology, people familiar with this? Deep ecology? Have you ever read it? Oh, this is great stuff. If you're interested in, you know, Darwin as kind of ideology, right? So in other words, taking all this kind of science I'm telling you about and then turning it into having some kind of moral lesson for how human beings ought to conduct themselves. This is the extreme side. These are the hardcore guys. Deep ecology, okay? Population control on humans, right? Early termination, both ends, abortion, euthanasia, the sooner the better, okay? Limit on consumption, radical. Those who can't, penalized. Okay? Human beings are basically, you know, the criminals of the planet on this view. Alright? The reason why I push this is that, you know, this is not some logical consequence of Darwin. Darwin never said any of that. But the point is, that if you take Darwin's view as a view that has some kind of lesson for human beings' place in nature, then it's a pretty negative place, or at least it's a place that doesn't privilege it, that's for sure. And so in this respect, it is very different from all those other kinds of progressive views. Okay? Now, if you reach the point of believing that Darwinism is true, and it has some kind of moral and political lessons, then the question becomes, well, how should you conduct your life? Now, one of the things that then troubled people about this, and I'm not talking just about the religious people, because the religious people, you can immediately see why they wouldn't like this, right? The Christians, the Jews, the Muslims, you can see why they wouldn't like this. So we don't need to really discuss that. But the kind of people we should be discussing are people like Darwin's own friends, like Thomas Henry Huxley, who was the great public defender of Darwin in this country, who was a surgeon by training, one of the founders of Imperial College London. And toward the end of his life, in the 1890s, Huxley gave a very influential speech called Evolution and Ethics, where he basically was kind of thinking, so here's Huxley about to turn 70 years old at the end of his life, at the end of the century, 1890s, okay, and thinking about, okay, Darwinism's been around now for over 40 years. It's had a big impact in the way people are thinking about things, no doubt about it. Not everybody accepts it, of course, but it's having influence. And so Huxley is wondering, well, should we be drawing some moral conclusions from this, some political conclusions from this? Because obviously guys like Herbert Spencer were doing that already. We mentioned Spencer before, and Huxley knew about all that. And Huxley, in his speech, basically was concerned that the kinds of values that we associate with civilization, which he meant, you know, high art and science and rule of law and medicine and all this kind of stuff that was really beginning at the end of the 19th century to modernize the world, not just, you know, in terms of there being big buildings and telegraph and all this kind of stuff, trains, but also even individual lives. Life expectancy was beginning to rise and things like that, okay? So, you know, people were beginning to get, you know, vaccinated against diseases and things like this. All that was already beginning to happen. And so Huxley's point was that that whole way of this kind of progressive, you know, more civilized, as they used to say in that time, way of being, was predicated on the idea that human beings have a special place in nature. In other words, that monotheistic worldview, however secularized it may have become in the modern period, nevertheless was still driving the game insofar as it presupposed that human beings have a special place. Okay? So, for example, you think about medicine. Increasing amount of research funding and political interest over the last 200 years has been in medicine. Okay? Why? Well, you want to keep people alive longer and keep them alive longer in a better state. But why? Look at Darwin. Darwin says death is normal. Things die. Right? That's the normal course of things. You live for a while, you die. Don't sweat it. Right? Why? This business about keeping people alive longer and keeping them productive and putting all of this time and effort and money into that kind of thing, when in the end, we're just dead just like everything else. Why do this? Why do this especially just for us? Now you see the animal rights people who are breaking into labs all over the place. Right? This is where they start to get on board, because they'll start to say, my God, you know, we're taking these poor animals, we're using them literally as guinea pigs, in all possible senses, right, to be able to test medicines for human beings. We would never take human beings to test them for medicine for animals. But aren't animal lives just as valuable as human lives? Okay? Where's the parity here? Where does the specialness of where, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, as human beings, we like human beings, but then to go so far as to then use other species to promote your own, that crosses the line. And then to put so much money and so much effort into something that just makes marginal, incremental improvements, you know, after all, how much longer can we be living? You know? And in what, how much better state, given how much money and effort we're spending? Okay? Now, it's quite clear that, you know, if you look at modern medicine and you look at, you know, at the Huxley, you know, is that you don't spend all this money, you don't put all this effort into it unless you believe human beings are pretty special. The so-called sanctity of life. Okay? That's a big one. And that, I know, has a lot of religious overtones. And it can be interpreted in many different ways. But there's something very fundamental about that in terms of motivating why we spend so much time, effort, and money on medicine. And Huxley's point as a surgeon was, well, you know, if we lived in a fully Darwinized world where people really took Darwinism seriously, and Darwinism was really our cosmology, you know, because it's one thing to say, oh, I believe Darwin's theory of evolution is true, but do we live our lives as if it were true? Right? Probably most of us don't. See, the deep ecologists are trying to urge us to do that, saying, well, look, Darwin's theory of evolution is true, and so we need to adjust our politics and our morals to fit it. Because it's ridiculous to say, on the one hand, we believe in this theory because it's scientifically the best, but at the same time, we have these 300-year-old, 400-year-old views about human privilege. Right? That's the thing. That's the tricky part. That's the tricky part. And this is the kind of thing that Huxley is trying to deal with here in his lecture, Evolution and Ethics. In fact, the more I think about it, I'm going to put a link for this week so you actually have a look at what he says. Because he really, I think, really touched on something there that I think is very profound, because it is very easy to, you know, if we say that science is the most authoritative form of knowledge in society, which I think most people agree, and then we say, well, we want to believe the best scientific theory, and then it turns out this is the best scientific theory. Well, then the question becomes, okay, how do you live your life in light of this best scientific theory? You just say, oh, it's only when I'm thinking about science that I believe this theory. The rest of the time, you know, I'm basically a secular Christian. That's weird. Okay? That's a very weird way to live. To say I believe in Darwin's theory of evolution, but I'm a secular Christian the rest of the time. It doesn't hang together very well. You know, and this is where people like Richard Dawkins start to... You know, because Richard Dawkins is basically saying, come on, people, be consistent. If you actually believe that Darwin's theory of evolution is true, right, and all of the so-called smart people seem to believe this, then you should just be an atheist. Don't pussyfoot around with agnosticism and all these other bullshit positions. Just be an atheist. Be consistent. See, that's where he's coming from on this. But actually, see, Richard Dawkins is not quite as consistent as he makes himself out to be. One of the interesting things about Richard Dawkins, for those of you who have any interest in the man, is that he's got this kind of interest that he doesn't talk much about, but I've picked up on biotechnology and human enhancement stuff. You know, and you wonder why. See, a Darwinist wouldn't be for that either. Right, the whole idea of human enhancement is, again, part of that whole medicine thing, right? We're just keeping people alive longer in some improved form. Why? Why not just let people die? That's natural. You know, why do you have to, like, put, you know, implants in their brains or their hearts or something like that? Just when they run out of gas, they just die. Into the scrap heap of, you know, the gene pool. You know, why not? But Dawkins is very interested in the enhancement stuff, in biotechnology and things. And I wonder, from a Darwinian standpoint, that doesn't make much sense to me. But that's another story. But Huxley is troubled by all this. So trying to keep the thing straight. Well, Huxley's solution, kind of long story short, is basically to say that what it means to be a human being is to resist natural selection. In other words, the motive, our whole modus operandi, right, what makes us human beings, the way we operate, is we are engaged in organized resistance to natural selection. What is distinctively human, what distinguishes us from all the other species, is not that we were anointed by God or anything like that, but that we go through collective organized effort to stop natural selection. So, you know, what's Huxley thinking? He's thinking about medicine, he's thinking about science, he's thinking about the rule of law. That's a very important thing for him, because Huxley has in the back of his mind people like Herbert Spencer. I don't know how much you know about Herbert Spencer's views, but one of the things that Herbert Spencer thought was really anti-evolution was the state. Okay, so Herbert Spencer essentially was an anarchist, and a lot of the Darwinists were anarchists. They're anti-state people. Now, why are they anti-state? Well, because to them, the state is a very unnatural formation, right? Because especially you think about states as they were forming, you know, as they began to exist in the late 19th century, and also in the context of empire, where states are extending their political authority overseas in a significant way. What you basically have is the idea, which Spencer believed from an evolutionary standpoint was a false idea, that people who, let's say, have very little physical interaction with each other, they're not part of the same environment, they don't necessarily provide for each other in any kind of direct way, they have no other kind of contact with each other, okay, somehow have to see themselves as mean citizens of the same country. In some sense, they get this identity with all these other people who they have otherwise nothing to do with. Okay? Now, the way things work in evolution, right, is that, you know, in ecology, right, which studies the way in which organisms live together in common physical space, right, people often talk about what gets known as symbiosis. Okay? And that's the idea that different organisms live together, they share the space, and they do things for each other, or at least they don't get in each other's way, so they can all thrive. And this is kind of an ideal kind of thing in ecology. And Spencer and a lot of these Darwinists basically thought that's the way social life should be organized generally. Should be these kind of symbiotic relationships. Now, a symbiotic relationship, though, only works in the common physical space. So the organisms have to actually be moving around roughly coterminous to each other. You can't have empires this way. You can't have big nation states this way. Okay? Because basically people, you know, as people pointed out, right? And remember, this is the late 19th century. It's not today where you can just hop on a plane and travel all over the place for 10 pounds. Right? People, even in the big nation states, never tend to go very far from home. And so Spencer's point was that the nation state was just putting an artificial burden on the natural default social patterns of people that had been validated by evolution. Now, what he had in mind specifically was things like taxation, redistribution of wealth through taxation, right? So the idea being, certain parts of the country are richer than others, you tax them more, give it to the poor ones. Because the late 19th century, as you probably know, is the period where we start to get social democracy. Of course, Marxism is an ongoing thing. People are talking about that. There's social democracy, again, the beginning of the welfare states in Northern Europe. Okay? Spencer's against all this. Right? He's against all this because it's artificial. Why should I, living in one part of the country, have to be given my taxes so some slob in the other part of the country, who I'm never going to meet, have nothing to do with, is then going to use for God knows what? Totally ridiculous, and definitely anti-evolution, okay? And, you know, Spencer basically argued that, you know, and as you know, the whole idea of redistributing wealth through the tax system has never been popular, okay? It really, usually people have to be threatened to do it. And Spencer's point was, at the end of the 19th century, was, well, why do you suppose that's the case? It's because it's so bloody unnatural. There is nothing natural about redistributing wealth from those who you care about and have interaction with to those who God knows who they are. There's nothing natural about that at all. And so basically, Spencer wanted to establish a state. And Spencer's view was that through spontaneous acts of charity on the part of people in their local communities, that the poor could be helped locally. And in places where the poor could not be helped, well, meet our friend natural selection, the Grim Reaper, right? Who says everybody's got to live? Part of Spencer's idea, and this was part of the Darwin ticket, was We have got to get used to the idea of dying. Dying is natural. Okay? And this whole idea that everybody's got to be saved. Everybody's got to live. Everybody's got to have welfare. That's just a hangover from the old Christian days, where every person is valuable in themselves because we're all children of the same God. But if there is no God to be the same children of, then it doesn't apply. In which case, those who can live will live, and they will be provided for by others. And those who don't have others to provide for them, well, they just die. And death is natural. It happens in the animal kingdom. Happens in the human kingdom. That's just normal. And otherwise, if you don't let that happen, what's going to happen is you're going to end up getting this very artificially inflated system, which is going to increasingly redistribute wealth, and it's not, and you're just going to have populations being maintained in this fashion. Growing, 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 but not necessarily providing for themselves. That was the argument. And this has been a very classic Darwinist argument against the state. And it's still used today, in fact. Okay. But see, this is what Huxley would say is an example of organized resistance to natural selection. Namely, where you sort of redo the world. You go against people's basic instincts in order to reach some more civilized level that you would never get in any other part of the animal kingdom. Okay? And this is what, and science can help you do that by keeping people alive longer, right? And by providing kind of the infrastructure whereby nation states can become consolidated. So, for example, you can have people learn the same languages, right? You can, there are all kinds of, you know, as you know, you've probably studied the sociology of the state is something that needs to be very actively manufactured, okay? And Huxley says that is, in fact, what makes us human beings, is engagement in those kinds of projects that go against natural selection. And the question is going to be, the extent to which these projects can continue to be motivated once everybody believes in Darwinism. Or will people just say, well, no, to hell with the state, to hell with science, to hell with medicine. We're just going to sort of live our lives, you know, in sync with the environment for as long as we do, and then we're just going to move over and let some other creatures take over. Because that's the natural course of things. End of story. That's all there is to it. Okay. And you see, as we move away from this period of belief in scientific progress, right, this way of thinking that says, well, you know, the state, what a crazy idea, you know, science, it's got its limits, you know, medicine, well, people supposedly like medicine, but then, you know, when you look at what people's attitudes are to things like genetically modified stuff, right, they get very upset about that too. You begin to say, oh, there's a retreat going on here. There's a sense in which people are adopting a worldview, at least partly due to an acceptance of the Darwinist scientific position. That means that human beings have to retreat a little bit. They have to sort of pull back their presence in the world. Okay? And so then it does become part of a sort of secular worldview. And it's not surprisingly that under these circumstances, you start to get a lot of sympathy showing for a lot of the Eastern cosmologies. Those things become very popular. Okay. So this is kind of the way in which evolution ends up, you know, a scientific view, but also a scientific view that in one sense, the only challenge it makes to religion is at the monotheistic level. Monotheistic religions is challenging. But then to the other cosmologies of the world that never privileged human beings in the first place and basically think, you know, we are one with nature, evolution is very compatible with that. Okay? And so these kind of debates between science and religion that go on are very much an artifact of the particular kind of religious culture that we've lived in, which has traditionally privileged human beings and in some sense pulled us out of a kind of naturalistic understanding of the world. All right. But at the same time, by pulling us out of a naturalistic understanding of the world, it also, somewhat ironically, created this kind of perspective that we associate with science. Namely, the idea that we can understand how the universe works, that we can make sense of it, that it's rational, that we can control it, that we can even maybe improve it. Okay. I mean, I think I may have told you that the term scientist was only coined in 1831, and the person who coined it, William Whewell, who was master of Trinity College, Cambridge, he was both a geologist and a priest. Okay? And his view was that science required people who had the same kind of dedication to a vocation that you would normally get in the priesthood. And I was mentioning earlier how, you know, in a sense, the way scientists conduct their day-to-day lives is very similar to how monks do it. Well, this is quite deliberate kind of role positioning, trying to... And Whewell thought that, in fact, that you needed to have a certain kind of almost religious dedication to understanding the world, that involved both the faith in that the world is intelligible and that you can make sense of it, and also that whatever little contribution you make in some way contributes to this kind of larger whole that will be figured out someday. And one place where you see this kind of idea kind of expressed for social science is, of course, Max Weber's speech, Science is a Vocation, which some of you may have read. If not, you should try to read that speech at somewhere. Science is a Vocation. And the word vocation, okay, in German, Beruf, is the word, Weber's using this word deliberately because it's the word that Martin Luther used to talk about the calling from God. Beruf, okay. And that's what Weber was talking about, that in a sense to be a scientist, right, is to receive a calling. Okay? So he's playing with that idea. So from having this kind of privileged view of human beings in nature, that the idea of scientists as a distinctive role in society gets created in the 19th century. But one of the products of that is Darwin's theory of evolution, which ironically calls into question the value of continuing to do science. Okay? And this is what Huxley is trying to address in his lecture, this kind of paradox, in a way. And I will provide a link to that lecture so you have a chance to look at it for next week, and we shall continue. All right. Nice.